It is not a legal requirement for UK charities to report on their environmental impact. Though sustainability is becoming an increasing concern to donors, beneficiaries and investors, it can be difficult for charities to discuss their green credentials publicly and harder yet for them to know where to start building them. This podcast, as part of Charity Digital's Climate Action Campaign, will discuss what charities need to consider when building an environmental policy and why, frankly, they need one. Charities have the potential to really lead the charge against climate change, and many already are. In this podcast, we're going to talk to three different charities who have embedded climate action into their operations, from joining environmental travel schemes to encouraging energy-saving measures among their networks. My name is Laura Stanley. I'm a content writer at Charity Digital, and I'll be your podcast host for this episode. Today, I'm joined by Catherine McAlpine, director at the Brunel Museum, Amy Moore, sustainability manager at Marie Curie, and Alison Ogden-Newton, chief executive of Keep Britain Tidy. All three of these charities have committed to environmental sustainability, though only one is defined as an environmental organisation. Climate change affects everyone, from every sector and industry, and you don't have to be an environmental charity to be environmental. But perhaps this is a good place to start thinking about the sector's role in sustainability. Why should charities of all kinds be thinking about environmental policy in 2023? Let's go to Alison.
Right. So, no, well, I think all of us, individuals and organisations, need to be thinking very much about the environment because it is the paramount issue. But I think charities in particular, because all of our charitable aims, all of the things that we're trying to achieve out there for good in the world, none of that will be possible unless we also have a light touch environmental footprint. But as for environmental organisations like Keep Britain Tidy, I think it's absolutely essential that we walk the talk and that we lead by example and use our own organisational experience to develop ideas and to assess the viability and potential impact of environmental measures so that we can talk more authoritatively about them and perhaps other people can learn by our example.
Mm. Completely agree. This is why the Climate Action Campaign is happening. We really think that, you know, we exist for the public good. It's about, you know, promoting that a bit more, I think. Catherine, when did the Brunel Museum start thinking about sustainability?
So I joined the Brunel Museum in January 2021 as director, and really kind of from the starting, you know, from me starting, I really wanted to make sure that we were a sort of climate conscious, sustainability conscious organisation. So we went through a process of a series of kind of stakeholder workshops to work out, you know, really where could we, you know, make the most impact in terms of, yeah, reducing our environmental impact, but also in terms of our kind of programming and what we're sort of communicating to the world. So we launched our sustainability strategy in August 2021.
That's quite a quick turnaround. How did that process, did it feel like it was a quick turnaround, or did it feel that you were ready to make that jump?
I'm quite an impatient person. So for me, it didn't, you know, I felt like it, you know, it could have come sooner. But actually, I think for us, taking that time and a lot, and really it's about the process as much of this as the, well, it's more about the process, I think, than the output. So we went through a series of stakeholder workshops with our volunteers, our on-site partners, our staff, our trustees. And I think by kind of bringing them on board, you have a much more effective kind of policy once you've kind of finally written it down and sort of established it. I think, and I'm sure we'll come to this kind of later on in the discussion, a policy isn't worth anything if you're not acting on it and kind of living it and breathing it every single day. But yeah, I do think that process is really kind of, that's the important part. And if that's the thing that takes time, then it needs to take time.
Mm, that's really interesting. Amy, what about you? What motivated Marie Curie to get on board with sustainability?
I think initially Marie Curie is a large organisation, had to complete mandatory reporting. So we have to complete our SECR for government annually. And we started doing that in 2019, and that was taken on by the Estates Directorate. And then I think from there, it just became clear that in order for us to meet compliance and in order for us to secure funding and to really move forward as a stable organisation, we needed a sustainability manager to kind of tie all that together and carry it forward. So Marie Curie recruited for a sustainability manager, which was myself, back in December 21. And what I've been doing is reporting on our carbon and then putting a plan in place to try and reduce our carbon. So we actually this week have just internally published our carbon management plan, which focuses on what our current footprint is and then how we're going to try and reduce that over time to get to a place of net zero. And that's something that we'll be publishing externally shortly. I think it's very much like Alison said, it's just for us, it's been a natural step because it's the right thing to do. And as a charity, we all have a mission around supporting either people, society, animals, nature, and that kind of ESG work just, you know, really, really fits together with the ethos of what a charity does. And we should probably promote more louder what the good work that we're doing and how we're already as an organization within our mission statement benefiting environment and society, and then just naturally having some more ambitions on top of that.
I think that's been one of the hardest parts of when we've been formulating the climate action campaign. It's, I think it's too tempting to see it as an environmental charity sort of thing, but actually it's not at all. Climate change will affect everyone, right? And I think it's really interesting to see how it can be pushed forward with charities from all sectors. And I guess that brings me quite neatly to the next sort of question. Have you had any trouble bringing anyone in your organisation on board? I guess Alison, you're everyone hired for Keep Britain Tidy, I imagine, is very keen on environmental sustainability.
Yeah, no, I don't think we had any problem convincing anybody really. Even the plant-based, our strategy and our policy now to have entirely plant-based catering for all internal and external events did not meet with any kind of dissent, because, as you say, we're all environmentalists. I think it's important, though, to note that even though we assume that everybody supports our environmental mission, we don't take for granted the fact that there's still, you know, improving our own standards and reducing our own impact internally isn't something we have to work at. And that we do need people who take the responsibility of safeguarding us through it and making sure that we stick to the things that we set out to achieve. It does need a degree of organisation and purpose, even an organisation where everybody's motivated. And the other thing I wanted to say, which was listening to Amy, I do think it's fantastic that other organisations are going down this route. And I think it would be wonderful if they promoted it so that other people can learn by their example too. Because in many ways, non-environmental organisations championing this work is more impactful.
I think that's very true. I think it's definitely a case of, I think when I'm looking up a charity, I think it's always great to see their environmental policy on their website. And we recently did a big article about ESG as well. And as I said, there's not a lot of legislation in the charity, but the charity sector is for public sector organisations, but not for the charity sector. And so I think it's really great having a policy in place, which is exactly why this podcast exists. Catherine, you've joined the Climate Perks scheme. Could you explain more about that and why you took it up?
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. So we are the very first museum to sign up for the Climate Perks scheme, which I'm particularly proud of. So Climate Perks is a scheme that was kind of pioneered by Possible, the climate action charity. And it's about kind of moving the dial on how people travel for their sort of big holiday. So one of the things that holds people back from taking kind of no-fly alternative, so train travel and things like that, ferries, is the time that it takes. It does take a bit more time to travel by train, though, actually, I think if you add up all the time that you have to spend, you know, at customs and, you know, waiting for your bags and getting to the airport that's usually out of the centre, I actually don't think it does add up. But what Climate Perks does is for any employees who want to travel taking a kind of no-fly alternative, they get an extra 2 days, up to an extra 2 days of annual leave each year. We're the very first museum to do it. And I think that's particularly poignant for us because we tell the story of the Thames Tunnel, of Mark Brunel's pioneering tunnelling techniques that not only made the Thames Tunnel possible where we sit, but also the Channel Tunnel. Over a century later, we can leave Britain by train thanks to those tunnelling techniques that Mark Brunel pioneered. So it feels like it really fits with not only our sort of environmental ethos, but our collections and our themes and the stories that we tell as a museum.
I love that connection, Catherine. I think that's absolutely fantastic. And of course, we owe Brunel so much. He's a bit like the Romans. What did Brunel ever do for you? But he did a lot, didn't he? And he opened an awful lot of doors. But I love that connection and the fact that you are promoting travel by train rather than flight. I always think it's fascinating. I mean, well, shocking, really, that for somebody, I'm somebody who doesn't fly. And haven't done for many years. And we look at all sorts of ways in which we can try and avoid it at all costs as a family. And obviously in the organization, I try and encourage people not to fly. But I just think it's really shocking that from where I stand, that actually flying is increasing despite the environmental impact. And it's increasing to the point that I think in 2050, it's going to account for 40% of emissions, which is absolutely staggering and seems so counterintuitive given that we know just how awful that impact is and how actually, you know, with a little bit of forethought and organising, most trips, not all trips, but most trips could be achieved either by land or by sea.
Yeah, I completely agree. And it's quite prevalent because we're talking about this at Marie Curie at the moment. But the other barrier for us is that often it's cheaper to fly. Mm-hmm. We live in that kind of a world, which just doesn't help really, does it? But yeah, we're absolutely weighing up that, you know, the train is probably similar in terms of duration and you can work on the train. And the emissions are, you know, sort of, I did work it out for one journey. It was sort of one fifth of what it would be to fly. Yet flying is often the cheaper choice. I suppose needs to be some kind of change around that to help some of us with our plans.
Yeah, no, it is very difficult. That is the perhaps the principal challenge for all of us, not just charities, which is that convenience and cost make the least environmental proposition the most exactly. affordable, which is a real mm-hmm. problem, isn't it?
Because
ultimately, it's going to cost us all an awful lot more.
Yeah.
So how do you sort of put sustainability at the height of that decision-making so it's not convenient, because I completely agree. Sometimes it's just like, well, that's so much cheaper, or that's easier. But if we're wanting to walk the walk, as Alison said, how do you make sure that the sustainability is in the minds of decision makers?
I mean, how we put it in the minds of sort of decision makers is by continuing to do the work that we do and insisting that, you know, that if we can establish principles to save the environment, that they can as well and should. And, you know, it's an essential part of leadership. You know, it's only 10 years ago. Well, what am I saying? We've still got climate deniers. We've still got people in government right now who are talking about it's not global warming, it's weather. You know, mm-hmm. and you know, in the face of that, we really do need to keep pushing and pushing and pushing that actually it isn't weather. It's extraordinary and it's egregious. And it will affect not only all of us, but the poorest first. And as such, it's everybody's responsibility to try and address that as a matter of urgency. And I think the thing about also, I think part of your question was about how do you get it onto the agenda and how as an organization, we're all cost driven. We all have to do everything that we can for as cheaply as we can. It's the nature of charities. And how do you choose essentially the more expensive option, particularly if you have that cost concern, which we all do. And I think it's a lot of things, but I do think in that sense, post-pandemic, we've learned that an awful lot of the ways that we were behaving before aren't necessary and we could achieve the same results. So obviously doing things virtually as we are today, and that can be done internationally. An awful lot of international correspondence meetings and conferences can be achieved virtually in a way that was inconceivable before the pandemic. And also asking the question, if we can't afford to send somebody in a more environmental way that's more expensive, then what exactly is it that we're going to try and achieve with this meeting? And is it really that important to the organisation that it could possibly warrant offsetting against that much of that greater carbon emission? Admittedly, in our thinking as an environmental organisation, the answer to that is almost always no. But I appreciate in other organisations, it can be much harder to arrive at that conclusion. But I think if we ask ourselves and we get used to asking ourselves, can we really, if we can't afford it, what is it that we're really trying to achieve here? And the chances are some of it might be learned or traditional behaviour. And then if we continue to use all the experiences that we've all gained about working virtually, hybrid working, and the much, much, hugely improved comms that have happened as a result of the pandemic, if we utilise all of those things, is it possible that we can achieve the result we're looking for through either a no-cost outlook or even a higher-cost outlook, because it really is that important to get a human being in situ. But, we've really thought about how important that is first rather than assumed that it's absolutely necessary. And unfortunately, there is a degree of leadership, not just in government, but also in charities, that does love a meeting and does love getting everybody together and does love, that kind of what they consider to be a sort of camaraderie of meeting. There is still a lot of meetings that I suspect environmentally we could have assessed as something that we perhaps might have been able to work around. But I think it's important to just keep asking yourself the question, really, is this vital?
Yeah, I think Alison's right that we've learned a lot from the pandemic. And if we're traveling less, which I know we're definitely doing in Marie Curie, then we can maybe afford to pay more for how we travel and just keep it to those essential journeys. But obviously, there's always a decision-making process. And for us at Marie Curie, these issues tend to be talked about in our environment and sustainability steering group. And anything we think where we might face a barrier, cost maybe being one, then we can kind of escalate that as a risk and put a proposal together. And then ultimately, it goes up the chain to decision makers. So that's kind of our process for when, we might face a barrier.
So now we come to external people. So we obviously want to make, as I said, I always Google a charity's sustainability credentials as much as I can. I think it is becoming increasingly a reputational issue. Amy, how do you make people who traditionally donate to Marie Curie understand your sustainability policy? Do they already?
I think so. For a lot of our supporters, the environment is important to us because we want to prolong nature for people that are terminally ill so they can enjoy it in the last days of their lives. We want to protect our patients and our services from the effects of climate change. Climate change will have a huge effect on healthcare services because of extreme weather and environmental related illness and health inequality. So we need to make sure that our services are resilient in the face of that. And yeah, as I say, we want to protect the planet for our patients so that they know that there's something left for their loved ones after they've gone. So I do think it is an important issue for our supporters. We do need to do more work to communicate with them what we're doing, because we've definitely kind of started the communication internally with our staff and volunteers, sharing what we're doing to make our operations more efficient and reduce our carbon emissions. But it's our intention to communicate really regularly with our external stakeholders about what we're doing, because I do think it's important to society. And then of course the bigger donors absolutely are asking us, what are you doing environmentally? It's within some of our contracts, so we need to make sure we're compliant. And a lot of the time, if we're applying for grants or funding, they want to know how we're mitigating our impact, how we're adapting our services, and what our plans are for the future. And it also kind of opens up a new pot of funding for things like sustainable capex projects for our buildings, trying to make our buildings more efficient. I think having the conversation is important to all of our stakeholders.
Make it seem like such a no-brainer. It's amazing. It's really it's really great to hear. Catherine, so have you had any feedback on your environmental policy from supporters?
No, actually. And I don't know if that's a sort of lack of comms on our part, or because actually people just take it as standard. That, you know, these days, yes, of course you have an environmental, or sustainability policy. I think for us, in terms of that sort of external facing, piece of work, there is that phrase sort of, there's no culture on a dead planet. We exist to, preserve and share widely the stories, the stories of Mark Brunel's groundbreaking tunneling techniques. But what are we preserving them for if there's no planet for them to exist on? So that feels like, kind of that's the starting point, I suppose, for us. And I think in kind of arts and cultural organizations like ours, there's kind of two sides to it. There's the reducing our environmental impacts that, like Alison and Amy have referred to, and kind of bringing our footprint as, as small as we possibly can be. But we're fairly small, our environmental footprint is fairly small to begin with. We're a small organization. We're a small, we have two very small buildings. So actually, even if we halved our impacts, we're not going to have a huge, that's not going to make a huge change. Where we can really change is, again, kind of shifting perceptions, shifting attitudes, kind of moving the dial, having that conversation with our visitors, with our audiences. And that's a piece of work that we're starting now. We've started with a few sort of book events and talking a bit more about our policies more widely, but really we want to kind of embed it in everything the organization does that's kind of public facing. But then the other side of that is, when you're doing all of this work publicly and saying, yeah, we're having these conversations about sustainable transport, we want, as we've said a couple of times, we need to walk the talk. We need to show that we're doing that work as well. So I think it's always about bearing in mind those two parts of our kind of our sustainability work. It's how can we use our platform to kind of change conversations more broadly and make things like kind of online meetings much more prevalent, or asking the question, shifting that mindset. Do we need to have a conversation? Does this need to be a meeting, or could it be an email? being the traditional one that we all, I think, know so well.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. We do. Yeah, we come from a world that's very, has its in its DNA, the love of a good all inclusive meeting, doesn't it? So yes, it's if anything, it's probably the hardest bit of culture to break. I was just really interested, Catherine, about your very modest kind of assessment that, you know, the museum is a small organization with a small impact. And I think from my point of view, the one thing I've learned to keep Britain tidy is that, you know, working collectively, no matter what size you start, you make a big difference. And we really firmly believe that, and we see it every day. So whenever people say, well, I'm just one person, or we're just one organization, or we're a small organization, actually, you know, that lovely adage that, you know, if you think that a small group of people with purpose isn't going to change the world, it turns out it's the only thing that ever did. And the other thing I think is really important as well, because there are lots of assumptions we make about when we act small, that it's not going to have a big impact. And one of the things in particular are our pension schemes. And one of the things we've offered staff in our pension scheme is a net zero pension scheme through Cushion, which I think they certainly claim to be the world's first net zero pension scheme, but certainly there are other products available. But we thought it was really important to offer people the opportunity to make sure that when money's invested on their behalf, particularly over the long term, that it is doing no harm, and potentially even is investing in the same sort of things we're all devoting our working lives to try and achieve. So, and in that sense, I think the more people who cotton on to making sure that there isn't any level of investment in charitable organisations in activities that we would otherwise, in any other dimension of our existence, not support. Again, I think acting small can have very, very big consequences, because that really will change the mindset of some of the big investment firms that are allowing some of the most harmful impacts on the environment, such as the impact of oil extraction, to happen. And without their investment capital, a lot of those industries would really struggle and become much more expensive and less competitive. So, you know, there are things that we can all do. And even though all of us might not be huge in our singularity, I think collectively we could mark a change that I think will make significant difference.
I am so pleased you mentioned pensions. I am always talking about pensions. The person who talks about climate friendly pensions in the museum sector. I'm so pleased you mentioned that. Yeah, I think a shout out to Share Acton and the work that they do on decarbonizing your pension investment. And, you know, I think it's a thing you can do on an individual basis. You can look at your own pension, where that's being invested, but also, again, even better if you can speak to your, you know, your HR person or your finance person in your organization and say, where is ours being invested? And you know, do a bit of digging. But again, Share Action have got some fantastic resources around which high street pensions are the most ethical. If you don't have time to sort of do a deep dive, I think that's a really great place to start. So yeah, I'm really glad that you mentioned pensions.
I'm glad you're glad. We have a finance director, Ruth, who never lets a meeting pass without making sure that everybody's on board and understands just how important choosing ethical solutions in our pension is. And she thankfully, you know, she was knocking on an open door, but whatever shortfalls we had in the past certainly have been addressed. And it's vital because when you look at any kind of absolute travesty in terms of economic development, it's, you know, the adage of following the money is always true, isn't it? And if you do follow the money, that's where you see some of the biggest harms and the biggest lies being told about, you know, how our convenient lifestyle is mitigated. It's not, you know, paying somebody to plant a few trees randomly elsewhere does not offset anything, really doesn't. It is so important to make sure our money isn't being abused whilst we look elsewhere.
That's absolutely fascinating. It's so great. This conversation it's given me a lot to think about. And what we can take internally ourselves. But there are so many different areas that sustainability affects. I'm going to sort of end on a little question just about, where do you think people can start if they're right at the beginning of their, I want to make an environmental policy, I want to make it tell everyone about it. Where do they start? Who wants to go first? Anyone?
So when I get asked this question in the museum sector, there's sort of two things that I ask people to kind of assess. And I ask them to think about where they sit within their organisation and what their spheres of influence are. So where they can, you know, where can they make sort of change quickly, either on an individual or kind of within their organisation? And then kind of panning out to the organisation at large, and who might their allies be, who might be the other people, because they won't be alone in thinking these things and wanting to do something. And I think when you find those allies, you know, there may well be, you know, a sustainability group that already exists. Maybe it needs a bit of, you know, TLC to kickstart it again. But if there isn't, you can always set one up. And then I, you know, I always kind of think about, you know, again, you know, follow the money. Where do you spend most of your money, and who are you then funding? Which is why, and I do think pensions are always a great place to start, because it's relatively straightforward on an individual basis to change your pension, and the impact that you can have versus the time it takes is just, it's in a really nice sweet spot where I think often climate action can feel like it's overwhelming, whereas this is a really sort of simple, straightforward thing.
I think Catherine's point about getting friends, getting alliances, working together, checking out who else feels the same way you do is great. But the one thing I would say to anybody looking at sustainability policy in their organisation is you don't have to do it all at once. You know, don't feel overwhelmed. Don't think that, you know, it's too much because you're all already at full tilt. Making small changes and starting small is absolutely fine and great and dandy. And then if you can get people excited and on board, and that's one thing I always find, because we work so much with community groups, you know, people get very excited when they feel that they're making a difference. And that in itself is such great energy in an organization, if people think that they can make changes that will help rather than hinder. And then I think also it's important, Amy made the point earlier, that not only were Marie Curie really embracing their environmental strategy, but they were aware that funders were starting to ask questions about where they were in terms of sustainability. This is a modern approach. It's an appropriate approach. All organisations, but certainly organisations with ethical objectives, need to have a sustainability strategy. It is the modern way of doing things, like equality and diversity. You cannot possibly be an organisation of this century and blind to the needs of sustainability. And even if you think you are, you're going to come up against funders who simply don't share that vision, and that will quickly draw your ambitions to a close. So it's not really stick, it's mostly carrot, because actually people want to work for an organization which is ethically and sustainably sound. Everybody loves doing it. You know, we've just run something called Buy Nothing New Month, and it's, you know, the energy is hysterical. It's just absolutely brilliant fun. It's creative. People come up with mad things. But one of the things I think I like most about it isn't what we've done with the public. It's the amount of our own staff members who've got involved in Buy Nothing New Month and experimented doing all sorts of weird and wonderful things. And do you know how much fun we've all had with it, myself included? Who knew Sprouts were our quiche hero? Anyway. it's fabulous stuff. So people love it. You know, it's great energy, and it's exactly what we're here to do, which is to make the world a better place.
I would say start with what's achievable as well. So, you know, it might just be that you're going to travel less and that you're going to facilitate hybrid working and use video conferencing. It might be that you're going to ask your staff to switch off more, and put some posters up about recycling. Things that you realistically think that you can do. And then obviously as that evolves, the policy can be updated. You can include greater ambitions. You know, you might have somebody in the organisation that becomes responsible for that policy then. But yeah, initially start with what things that you are doing or that are achievable for you, because like we said before, every small thing makes a difference and it can only grow from there.
I think that's brilliant. It's been so inspiring talking to you all. Thank you so much. Yeah, it's been such an interesting discussion. I think everyone can see now that charities clearly have an important part to play in tackling climate change. And with donors and funders looking all the more closely at environmental credentials, it's worthwhile getting our houses in order. So for more information on environmental sustainability in the charity sector, you can find the Climate Action Hub on the Charity Digital website, and we'll also link to it in the description too. We have lots of articles, webinars, podcasts coming up all on climate action, and you can find it there in one handy place. And thank you so much for listening. Thank you to our guests for taking the time to join us. Hope you have a lovely day. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this Charity Digital podcast. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not represent the views, thoughts, and opinions of Charity Digital. The material and information presented here is for general information purposes only. Thanks for listening.